Hello, and welcome back to the Reverend Gentleman Podcast. It's been a little bit since I last uploaded something, but I really didn't have something that I was really happy with. So today I'm going to try to make something that I think would benefit anyone who listens to it, and especially benefit my listeners. I was going to put this out as a written blog post, but today I decided, you know what, I don't really want to do any writing, so I'm just going to put it into the next podcast idea and release it the next day. So today we're going to be talking about the ferocity of leadership and why having someone who has drive as leader of the team is a lot better than just having anyone, the leader of a team. So this is generally dealing with a scenario where you have an individual who is assigned over a group or set of groups in order to achieve an objective. This isn't a natural hierarchy. This is a little bit modified into something what you would think of as a military organization, or more applicably, a business or employer setup. So we take Bob, we set him over district or We set him over group C, or we take Jeanette and put them over group A and stuff like that. So assigning someone to lead a group is extremely important, and having a competent leader is even more important than it is to have a leader. In fact, I saw a fantastic example of this online today. They were talking about way back in 2000 when they were first getting out the D20 variant of Star Wars for tabletop playing, and they had a British man come in who had apparently, through the story that they implied, did things with the French Resistance or had anything else. And while every other group had failed to complete the basic module of this Star Wars scenario, this guy, with his wife and three random teenagers, managed to defeat the entire first episode of this module without any Jedi and without losing anyone, compared to everyone else during that entire evening could not complete this module, and everyone had the entire group die. It was a complete utter failure across the board, except for this one guy who knew absolutely what he was doing, because he had done it in real life. So what we have to do today is figure out, all right, who is the most capable individual to be in a position of leadership? There are a number of hallmarks of leadership that can be covered in as many books as there actually are about them, and they just reiterate some of the exact same points and maybe add in a few others or have a bunch of extraneous material and try to make it sound a lot better and more complicated than it actually is. So we're going to focus in on one of the major aspects, and that is drive for determination, a certain level of ferocity that is necessary for someone to be a leader to exhibit. An individual who has drive is going to be able to an extent, motivate others, because if they're excited about trying to do something and it's the same goal as that what you're trying to achieve, they're peppy energy can help positively infect you so that, yeah, we're going to do this. Let's go. That's why we have like cheerleaders, both male and female, and people who just kind of try to whip up people to get them excited about something and get them to focus on this one main objective. You know how people come out on stage or whatever you're writing, and they just kind of whip up the crowds like, yeah, let's get excited about this concert or something else. You know what I mean? An individual who has drive in a leadership position is pretty much doing that, only on a much smaller scale. You might have two or three individuals listening to this rallying speech, or being directly influenced by this individual, or you might have a whole department. So that's why you have to have someone who is moderately a people's person to motivate people. It's just kind of that simple. They themselves have to have a drive to achieve something in order to be able to try to stoke that drive in other people. You can get the best, the most absolutely qualified group of individuals, the best in all the fields, and put them all in the group, and you can set someone who has absolutely no drive at the top of it, has no motivation, has nothing going for them, has nothing at all, and that entire group will fail. It's not because they have the means, they absolutely have the means, is that they're not going to be guided or encouraged to succeed by the individual who is in charge of them. It's very much the shepherd example within the Bible. Sheep just go wander all over the place, but they need somebody to focus them. And this is generally the shepherd. And the shepherd watches over people, or watches over the sheep, watches over the flock, make sure it's safe, make sure they have everything they need, and just kind of guides them to an end that is beneficial for everyone. Just as generally feeding pastures, watering, places for them to sleep comfortably and safely, while making sure that none of them get hurt. And this is, in essence, what leadership is. And so someone who has a drive is going to be able to help motivate that group of individuals much more easily than someone who really doesn't care. That's why you have to have just the tiniest amount of drive. Even a tiny amount of drive is better than absolutely no drive. Because if your only drive is to get up, you know, maybe have some coffee in the morning and just kind of laze around that day is not a day for leadership. If you get up, it's like, okay, we're going to get things done today. We're going to make sure Bob and his team absolutely gets the stuff done that we assign them, and we're going to help make sure their job is as easy as possible, or at least as without hiccups as possible, so that we can get this project done. Yeah, we're going to do that. You're going to have that guy be in charge, or at least he's going to be the one who's going to be trying. He or she is going to be the one who's going to be trying to move the people along, help them encourage themselves, and really try to achieve something. And it really is the difference between an entrepreneur and someone who's not going to go anywhere. The entrepreneur has a goal they want to achieve, and the person who just doesn't give a crap is just going to kind of sit there and petrify. And that is the importance of having a drive. I've brought this up in a number of times, a number of videos and podcasts that I actually haven't published because I wasn't happy with them. I want to put out as good a product or set of information as I can to benefit as many people as will listen and will actually want to improve themselves. So if I'm not happy with it, I don't really want to put it out there for your consumption, because I want to have a beneficial impact on people. So that's my motivation. And if I'm going to be helping people who want to also achieve that, that means I can help guide them, because we both have the same goal. We want to help people improve. We want to help people achieve things that they really want to do and improve their lives, improve their skills, and improve overall so that they can live better lives, be more successful, and generally be happy with themselves. If you go to people, it's like, oh man, life is so terrible. It's generally because they have nothing to live for. I don't mean like, oh, they're going to kill themselves because they have nothing to live for. No, it's just that it's the same routine over and over and over and over and over again. They have no goal to focus their energy toward. And an individual with drive can help maybe fan the flames of their drive, or help them develop a drive themselves. It's the very basic fundamental concept that an individual who is in a leadership position needs to lead. They need to be the first ones out there. They need to be getting as much information about a certain area or location or project as they can, or assign people to bring them that information so that they can understand the scenario and start moving people toward it. It's like, okay, going back to the military examples, like we're going to have... From like this documentary I watched a long time ago, it says there's a difference between being a leader. You're not going to be a leader and say, all right, boys, you're going to take Hill 42. No, you're going to go out in front with your weapon and say, all right, boys, we're taking Hill 42. So you have to be able to be in the forefront and also be able to be kind of also midway in the back so that you can corral your people. It's like, okay, we're going this way. This is going to be the field decision. We're going to do this, and we're going to try to actually succeed in something, which actually brings us into a very particular topic, which we'll get to after this message. Okay, after that nice little segment, we're going to be talking about field leadership. There's an interesting dichotomy. People think that the applications of leadership that people have in the military and people have in the business world are two completely separate entities. The reality is they come from roughly the exact same tree. They're just different branches applied in different methods. But the basic concept is actually can be found in small unit tactics within the German military, particularly in World War II. This came out of the stormtrooper methodologies that were used to help break the stalemate of the First World War. And it's a very interesting topic that I encourage you to research on your own and listen to some of the YouTube videos that I've listened to, which is pretty much War Techniques Visualized, I think is the name, but don't quote me on that one. The thing of it is that you had within the basic German squad, and this was eventually kind of copied throughout the rest of the world because it worked. It has nothing to do with the political ideology that required them to have such individuals going out. It was a good idea, and people started to adopt it. Eventually, everyone in World War I had the equivalent of stormtroopers like the Germans had, and eventually the basic squad mechanic was also adopted by several other militaries after World War II. But there's a difference of usages depending on each military's methods. And today we're just going to be looking specifically at the German method. All right, so they had the squad leader, we had his second in command, then we had the primary firepower of the squad, which was the machine gun and his reloader, and riflemen that were divided into a couple of other things, such as one I think was a medic. It's been a while since I've researched this, so bear with me. But there's a couple guys with rifles, and their job was pretty much to help seize land that the machine gun would provide cover fire for them to be able to go in and take a position. Their major mythos was centered on the use of the machine gun, whether it was an MG-34 or an MG-42, because it had the fire superiority compared to bolt-action rifles, because even with six guys with bolt-action rifles, you cannot get the same rate of fire as any machine gun ever made. And the part of the German command realized this. It's like, okay, we're going to reshape our tactics to employ this machine gun as best we're able. And everything else was kind of secondary to that. And they worked their way around this concept of the maximum amount of firepower is where the most effect is. So they would move out of cover of fire provided by the machine gun. And the machine gun would move up, take a position, or after the position has been taken, after the area has been pinned down and cleared out, and they would just kind of work their way around this machine gun. And the important thing of this was that part of the doctrine that was really not necessarily revolutionary, but was really effective and is still used today in asymmetric warfare concepts, is that the squad was its own unit that kind of coordinated with other squads and then coordinated with high command. Back in the old days, it would be high command pretty much has to okay every single movement. And people thought, you know, that is stupid. The people who know exactly or know part of what's going on are the ones in the front lines, in the field, doing the work, which would be the squad leader. And even then, you don't really understand what's going on, but they have a little bit better grasp because they actually can see it or attempt to understand it than some guy all the way back in the bunker. So they were given a level of autonomy. So if squad leader A thinks, you know what, we absolutely need to take that hill and be able to secure the area, he had the authority in order to be able to lead his squad to that hill, take it, and overlay the area. Although, additionally, the second in command would receive, was the one generally using the radio. They would be coordinating with other squads and coordinating with high command so that they can say, okay, here's our new orders. Here is our linked to the situation beyond what we can visually see in here, which is not very far in combat according to records, but it's still a lot better than somebody well far away. And the situation, this is how they were situated, was the squad leader, the primary squad leader, was up in the front, and the secondary squad leader was actually in the back. So that way, if the squad leader's killed, the second in command is not more than likely killed with him. And so there in the back, it's like, oh crap, our main guy just went down. Okay, quick, transfer command to the guy in the back so that they can start pulling us back and clear out the area and not be all centralized, having our eggs, our leadership eggs, in one basket for them all to be cracked. With that mentality, it's generally how you can set up a very effective team in business. You have the guy in charge, and then you have his next in command, and they are going to be the ones that kind of do a little bit more of the legwork, but are the ones you would send to, okay, I need to find out this information, but I don't have time because I'm doing my duties. Find out stuff for me so that I can make a better decision, help keep me informed. While the other ones are help keeping people informed, peddling information back and forth, then the actual task can be assigned to the people underneath the highest power structure within the team, and they will be doing their jobs. And the squad leader's just there, or the team leader's just there to kind of make sure they're doing it, see if anything needs to be changed. Do we need more resources? What resources do you need? I'll send it up the chain, see if we can get those, and okay, focus the group. That was the major service of a team leader. They're there to focus the group. And that's why they need to have motivation. They need to have drive. They need to have a level of ferocity in order to achieve leading that group. Because if they're timid, if they're not really sure about course of action, and they show that timidness and they hesitate about something, that could waste a lot of resources, and in combat can get people killed. You can find this in online gaming all over the places. If somebody is running around, they just kind of stop and reconsider, they're going to get cut down, especially if it's a very cutthroat level game, which is more realistic. Instead, they need to be able to say, okay, we're going to make a decision, and once we reach that, we're going to make a decision, we're going to reach this short-term goal, and if the short-term goal reveals that our priorities have changed, or that we need to start doing something else or do something different, we're not in the midst of us trying to achieve a goal. So we take the short-term goal, and we find out that the next path to the next goal that we have to do has changed. We're not going to try to change it in the midst of achieving another goal, because then that really changes the momentum, and it's going to cause a massive breakdown of resource usage and a few other things, and it's going to really muck up the whole system. So I think one of the problems that leaders have is that they try to change in the midst of an action. And while that might work in hand-to-hand combat, it's not going to work in using field tactics. It's like, okay, we come up against some resistance and we can't get through it. Okay, we're going to change. That's different than, okay, we're going to try to achieve something. Maybe we'll do something else. They have to first strike into the first objective, take that objective, or see if that objective actually can be achieved. And once they've reached that momentum, I found out, okay, we've achieved the objective, now we have to change to another objective. That is when the kind of thinking goes into it. Because you have to first commit to an action and follow it through before you actually change to another action. It's kind of like physics. Once you start something rolling, it's really hard to get it to veer off and do so with the same amount of force that you want to achieve something with. So like bowling, you're going to roll it down there and it's going to go along with the planes, and then it's going to hit something and knock everything else down. If that suddenly tries to change in the middle of that, it's not going to have as much inertia to be able to knock down the bowling pins. And for us, the bowling pins are the objectives, what the success that we're trying to do at that time. So if you lazily try to do something, you're not going to be able to achieve it because you don't have enough momentum to carry you through and to overcome the obstacle. But if you put enough force out to try to achieve that objective, you can't really redirect that in the midst of achieving it. And if you do, things are going to mess up. You're going to toss metaphorical monkey wrench into your machinery, and it's going to break the whole scenario down. And that is what generally happens. People start to panic. And one of the reasons why you want a guy with drive is because they can put that ferocity into their followers, and it gets to the point where it kind of is like a little bit of blinders, so that it's like they're being pushed and they want to follow the guy who has the drive because he obviously knows what he's doing, or at least has the confidence that they'd be able to achieve it. And they kind of can focus in on the point, but they still, of course, need to focus on what's going on around them. But they have to be able to focus in on achieving the objective. And once they've achieved that objective, they can reassess the situation. Otherwise, if you stop and think about something, then all your momentum has left you, and it all starts to break down, and oh my god, we're starting to lose, and it's this very, very tenuous line between success and failure. And that's one of the reasons why you gotta be a little ferocious when it comes to trying to achieve things, because it's the knife edge. It's the knife edge between success and failure. And if you're just kind of hobnobbing around and not really doing anything, and oh, we can do whatever, you're not going to be able to succeed. I actually have a perfect real-life example of this. For years, I have been in a youth symphony, and only recently I've gotten out of it. And I still helped well beyond my required time. There were two absolutely polar opposite conductors for the symphony, and they were not there at the same time. In fact, one actually had participated in the symphony while the other one was there, well before I was there, because I watched the symphony when I was a kid, and then eventually when I was old enough to be able to participate, I participated. One of my most favorite conductors there was a guy by the name of Mr. Pacherek. Now, Mr. Pacherek was a very intense, very, very accurate individual in regards to musical practice. He teaches music theory and music, for lack of a better term, music science. I don't know the right term for it, but he teaches this stuff at college. And so he expected a lot out of the players because he knew we could do it. And if he didn't think we could do it, he would not try to get us to do it. But he also expected a lot of himself. He really was trying to do the best he could when he was playing music. He wanted to be very exact with the notes, with the, if it was written there, and if it told you to get louder while doing this really hard and complicated thing, he would absolutely try to get louder and play the very complicated thing. That was just how he was. He expected a lot out of other people, and he expected a lot of himself at the exact same time. And that really shaped me as a musician, because like, I know you guys can do it. I can do it. I know you can do it. And therefore, we're going to do it together, and we're going to make this piece played absolutely fantastic, because the potential is there and you definitely have the skills to do it. That was a leader with a drive. Fast forward, after when he unfortunately had to leave, a couple of conductors later, we had, I forget her name. Anyway, she really wasn't as driven of a conductor. It's like, okay, we'll practice this a couple of times. Yeah, that sounds good. That'll do. And so, while it was significantly different, if a really hard piece for the stringed instruments, because I was brass, had to be done, and they had to really work it to get it done and get it nice and polished so that it was a fantastic piece, Mr. Pacherek would take the strings to another room, and they would absolutely work it out until it was satisfactorily above where it needed to be in order to be able to be performed well. That really didn't happen with this other one. It was kind of like, okay, we'll bring you into another room. Ba, 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 ba. Okay, we're done. We tried that for a little bit. Okay, fine. This is good enough. And it was a lot. It was a much different dynamic. One of probably the best violinists I know, she also, for a short time, had this individual as her violin teacher. And she's like, nah, I'm not following this individual, because they didn't do like the basics. They didn't cover, okay, we're going to work on how to do notes. We're going to have to do like the barest minimum of what practicing a musical instrument requires, which is practicing scales, working on basic tempos, and like really taking pride and really taking the time to master the instrument. It was more like, okay, do a couple of these things, do a couple of those things, we're done. Oh, then we can move on from that. It's like, but compared to other individuals who, when I was doing, when I was learning how to play trumpet, my teacher, Mrs. Kinzer, was like, okay, play this. We're going to do your assignment for this week is you're going to be able to play this scale from memory without looking at the book. I want you to practice that. Next week would be, all right, did you do it? Yes or no, I did do it, or I did practice it. Well, practice it again. Here's the test. Can you play it? If I play it, yay. Here's the next assignment. You're going to be able to play this one. All right, now you're going to play this variation of it. Now you're going to play this variation of it. That wasn't present with this particular conductor, or when she was leading the symphony, or teaching people, from what I've heard. So this is secondhand. So take it with a grain of salt, but I could see that that secondhand information really matched what I was seeing directly, which was as a violinist, fantastic individual for playing music. She was really good at it. For conducting and teaching, not somebody I would send somebody to if they were really serious about learning how to play music. I would go with Mr. Pacherek all day, every day for teaching people how to do music because he was passionate about it. He knew what he was doing. He was doing his best and he wanted to succeed and he wanted those he was teaching to succeed. He had the drive to strive for excellence. And that's what he expected both out of himself and his students. That's to me why he was one of the best co-conductors I've ever played music under, because he expected so much out of the people. And he had that ferocity to try to achieve that goal of greatness. So keep that in mind, especially when you're dealing with leading people or having a leader. Remember that a little bit of ferocity and a little bit of drive can go a long way. So find someone with drive and find someone that your people can work with, and you might have much more success than you expect than someone who gets along with everyone but has absolutely no drive. So I'll catch you next time. Subscribe to our WordPress blog, which is the Gentleman's University Manliness at WordPress.com. Follow us at The Irreverent Gentleman on Facebook. And catch you next time. I hope you learned, and always think about it and consider how it can apply to you. Okay, you can stop recording now. Sigh.